Hello, I'm Tom Bondurant, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup podcast, featuring new comics from July 22, 2009, including Blackest Night, Tales of the Core number 2, Final Crisis, Legion of Three Worlds number 5, Final Crisis Aftermath, Dance number 3, Gotham City Sirens number 2, Green Lantern number 44, Madame Xanadu numbers 11 and 12, The Spirit number 31, Power Girl number 3, Supergirl number 43, and Wednesday Comics number 3. And we begin this week with Final Crisis Legion of Three Worlds number 5. It's the conclusion of a mini-series which began actually around this time last year. And it's one of those mini-series which involves George Perez drawing scores of characters spanning decades worth of comics and interacting in ways which are probably meaningful only to those people who have been reading comics for an equal amount of years. And since that describes me, I have to say I did like this mini-series. I found the conclusion to be pretty satisfying, clever in how Geoff Johns at last puts a stopping point to the story of Superboy Prime, and intriguing in terms of where it leaves the various legions and affiliated characters. And again, this is not a book for the uninitiated, but these days I suspect that there is really no such thing as a casual Legion of Superheroes fan. Next up is the only miniseries in the Final Crisis Aftermath collection that I'm reading. It's called Dance, and it is about the Super Young Team, a team of superheroes from Japan who are being exploited and co-opted by essentially the same kind of people who recruit boy bands and Spice Girls and groups of that nature. And to tell you the truth, I'm not getting a whole lot out of this miniseries. I like the writer, Joe Casey. I like the penciler, Chris Cross. And I enjoyed the Super Young Team as sort of a broad parody in Final Crisis. But for some reason, it's just not coming together for me here. And that may just be a poor fit between book and reader. Moving on to the Blackest Night portion of the podcast, it's Green Lantern number 44, written by Geoff Johns, penciled by Doug Monke, inked by Christian Alamy and Tom Nguyen. This issue will probably not make much sense to you if you have not already read Blackest Night number 1, and indeed, I think if you have read Blackest Night number 1, you may still be a little confused, as I was, because it picks up with the Flash and Green Lantern fighting the Black Lantern-ified Martian Manhunter, but last I saw in Blackest Night, they were all in the basement of the Justice League headquarters, and not out in a graveyard, as this issue finds them. Where this issue finds them, I should say. So it feels like there's a whole lot of setup in this issue, not just for Blackest Night, but for the JLA miniseries Cry for Justice. The issue ends without any resolution to the fight with Martian Manhunter, and in fact it ends on a cliffhanger, which I presume will lead into next issue and focus on Jon Stewart. And yes, that would be Jon Stewart the Green Lantern, not Jon the comedian, just for those of you who are new. I mean, it's not incompetently done by any stretch, it's just the subject matter is a little transitory, as I said. I continue to like Monkey and Alamy and Nguyen, although the Martian Manhunter attacks GL and Flash with some sort of weird skin disease, it looks like, and I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Add that to the lack of continuity between this issue and Blackest Night number 1, and it's just, you know, it's just sort of there. The same kind of applies to Blackest Night Tales of the Core number 2, which was written mostly by Johns, except for the last story, which was written by Peter Tomasi, and penciled and inked by various artists. As with the first issue, there are three stories in this issue, each focusing on a different Lantern Corps. There's the Tale of the Red Lantern, which is penciled by Eddie Barrows and inked by Rui Jose, and it is very much in the mold of 70s feminist exploitation, or quasi-feminist, I suppose, exploitation movies like I Spit on Your Grave. The Red Lanterns are motivated by rage, and this woman has a number of unspeakable things happen to her, most of which we get to see, or at least are heavily implied happen. And really, it's not a very pleasant story. The second story picks up with Carol Ferris, Star Sapphire, who is, of course, an a Green Lantern supporting character of long standing, both as Hal Jordan's love interest and as the villainous Star Sapphire. And it comes across a little bit better, mostly because of the art of Gene Ha. However, it's also kind of predictable in that Carol Ferris has been on the periphery of the Green Lantern mythology for the past several years, and I think this is John's attempt to sort of bring her back into Hal's orbit, regardless of what other writers have tried to do with her. And so when the Star Sapphire ring shows up and convinces her and basically talks her into becoming a Star Sapphire again, I think we kind of know where it's headed, where it starts talking about, well, don't you really love Hal Jordan, and don't you, you know, want to be with him forever and all this stuff. It's not too hard to hear the voice of the author and all of that. And the last story is probably the most clever. It's a tale of the Orange Lantern, which is motivated by greed, and it concerns itself with this massive, you know, almost stereotypical planet-devouring alien which shows up on this world's doorstep demanding sacrifice and food and, you know, sustenance, whatever else. But it runs afoul of an Orange Lantern, and therein lies the shocking twist ending of the story, which people who are familiar with the Orange Lanterns probably won't find as much of a twist. But still, it's drawn by Tom Mandrake, who gives it the kind of scratchy, expressive feel that he does so well. Next is Gotham City Sirens, written by Paul Dini and drawn by Guillaume March. The issue starts out with Catwoman tortured and ends with Harley Quinn kidnapped. So I'm hoping that's not a trend for this book. In the middle, we find out what's happened to Tommy Elliott, who you'll remember from Streets of Gotham has been masquerading as Bruce Wayne. He and Harley hook up in this issue. Well, not hook up in that way, but Harley appreciates the fact that Bruce Wayne helped her get out of jail. Specifically, he signed, the real Bruce Wayne that is, signed Harley's release papers. So Harley saves Bruce Wayne, quote-unquote, from would-be kidnappers and, or robbers, bad guys at any rate, and gets herself in trouble for it. And I have to say, I've kind of soured on this series, sadly, with it just being its second issue, but I'm not finding myself interested in any of these characters, really, despite Dini writing them. I mean, I tend to like Dini, I tend to give him the benefit of the doubt. It's just that he's done better work with these characters in the past, and I'm not seeing much of that here. And Marsh's art is okay. I'm noticing more TNA in this issue than I did last issue, for whatever that's worth. So, I don't know. I may give this another issue to see how the Harley subplot turns out. Also to see if he does anything more interesting with Poison Ivy, who I thought was used fairly well last issue. But me buying this book over the long term doesn't look really promising. Up next is Supergirl number 43, written by Sterling Gates, penciled by Jamal Eagle and inked by John Sibbell. It takes a break from the ongoing New Krypton arc to actually show us a little slice of life of Supergirl in the context of New Krypton, specifically her gilding day, which is the Kryptonian ceremony where a citizen gets to choose what guild he or she is going to join. Kind of like career day for the rest of your life. This means we get to see Supergirl touring the various guilds on New Krypton, the labor guild, the religious guild, the artists guild, the science guild. It also gives us a bit of insight into her surviving parent, Allura, who's been kind of the Lady Macbeth of the world of New Krypton storyline. But Gates here actually does a lot with her, with Allura. Shows us a different side to her character that sort of informs her actions since she came back into Supergirl's life. And I thought it was a well-done one-off issue. It may even be a good introduction to the world of New Krypton setup, since it does offer that tour of the planet. It features a guest appearance by Superman and his role in the military guild. And again, just sort of serves as a overview of where all the various factions stand. The art is good as always. I'm a big fan of Jamal Igle, and I think he's done a good job with Supergirl, both the book and the character. Up next is Power Girl, which in a sense is a book about the same character, only an alternate sort of older, more experienced take on her. Power Girl is essentially the cousin of a Superman from a parallel universe. She's older than Supergirl, who's a teenager or young adult probably by now. And she's the chair of the Justice Society of America, but she doesn't wear the familiar Superman symbol, and people tend not to think of her as part of the Superman family for various reasons. At any rate, I was kind of soured on Power Girl number 2, mostly because it was an origin story for the Ultra Humanite, the villain of the piece, and Power Girl spent most of the issue hooked into Ultra Humanite's brain-sucking machine, pretty much immobilized and gagged, and you know, wasn't a good issue as far as Power Girl was concerned. And so this issue finishes up that arc. Right off the bat, we see that Power Girl is a little more versatile than Ultra Humanite gave her credit for. She uses one of the lesser-known superpowers, or at least one of the more mockable superpowers, to get out of Ultra's death trap. And there's, you know, no small part of meta-commentary in that sequence. She then defeats Ultra Humanite without too much trouble, and the bulk of the issue is her saving the island of Manhattan from falling from a great height. And, you know, it's a well-done issue. I enjoy Amanda Connor's art. The issue was written by her husband, Jimmy Palmiotti, his writing partner, Justin Gray. And when they're focused on Power Girl doing superheroic things, they do pretty well. They're a little less successful when they show us Power Girl's new supporting cast. And the issue kind of is, I don't want to say derailed, but I was reminded that there are comics out there that I haven't read when a superhero from one of those comics shows up and ends up being instrumental in Power Girl's rescue of Manhattan. So I was like, where'd she come from? And was she in this book before that, you know, the writers had pointed out? And I'm still not entirely sold on this book for those reasons, but I don't know. I probably won't get issue 4. It features, from the tease at the end of this issue, it features, you know, a trio of intergalactic Spice Girls who are bent on mayhem, and, you know, doesn't really thrill me. So, may end up picking up the trade paperback if I hear good things about the next arc, but this book has some potential. I'm just not seeing it completely realized. Next up is Will Eisner's The Spirit, number 31, featuring a story that has nothing to do with the spirit fighting bad guys in a graveyard on the cover. It's written and penciled by Mike Plug and inked by Dan Green, and it is the first part of a two-parter involving leprechauns and a mysterious island. And considering that The Spirit started off in a series of Sunday supplement comics pages in very short stories, this is practically shaping up to be a spirit epic. And really, I thought it was a good issue. I thought it hewed pretty close to the Will Eisner style, both in character design and storytelling. We don't normally see things like leprechauns in The Spirit, but I thought the leprechaun here added a lot of whimsy, or had the right amount of whimsy, I should say, for the tone of the book. And I'm interested enough to want to read the conclusion next issue. It's not really new comics, but next up is Madame Xanadu, issues 11 and 12. If you've been keeping up with Comics Ate My Brain, the website, comicsatemybrain.blogspot.com, you'll know that I read the Madame Xanadu paperback, which covers issues 1 through 10, and found it to be tremendously engaging. Decided to get the most recent couple of issues at the comic shop this week, and they are More of the Same, written by Matt Wagner and drawn by Michael William Kaluta. The storyline picks up where the paperback left off, with Madame Xanadu essentially running a consulting paranormal investigator service in 1940s New York. It's very reminiscent of Wagner's earlier Vertigo series from the 90s, Sandman Mystery Theater, which followed the Golden Age Sandman in a series of sort of revisionist adventures. And in fact, this arc features Diane Belmont, who was the Golden Age Sandman's significant other. This Madame Xanadu storyline also looks back to the Spanish Inquisition, you know, insert Monty Python joke here. Essentially, it's, you know, that the various threads haven't really connected themselves yet, but there's lots of evildoers, obviously, back in the days of the Inquisition, and this mysterious Ra's al Ghul looking fellow with his demonic dog in the present day. One suspects that Sandman, the Golden Age Sandman, will also be involved at some point. Michael William Kaluta was one of the original Madame Xanadu artists back in the 70s, and his work here is a lot different than the regular artist Amy Reeder Hadley, but it still looks fantastic. I mean, obviously, Kaluta is a well-respected artist, and his work is a little more intricate, a little more studied, I'd say more detailed than Hadley's sort of manga-influenced work, but it's all good. And Wagner's script is as lively as I found it to be in the paperback. So I'm glad that I made the decision to sort of follow Madame Xanadu in regular series form. I think it'll be entertaining to keep up with it month to month and not just wait for the paperbacks. I may have to drop one of my other series in order to find room in the budget, but based on actually just what I've been saying this week, that shouldn't be too hard. And the next issue of the arc comes out next week, so good timing on my part. Closing out the week is Wednesday Comics number 3, which finds its various series settling into, I suppose, what are comfortable grooves. This also means that they are settling into various ranges of quality, from, let's say, fantastic to ambitious to just meh. And to get the bad news out of the way first, I would put Teen Titans by Eddie Braganza and Sean Galloway, and probably, I hate to say this, but the Superman strip by John Arcudi and Lee Bermejo into the meh category. Teen Titans still has its problems with, well, basically not much going on beyond the Teen Titans being attacked and a new set of characters, arrogant doctors, essentially, coming in to patch them up. Teen Titans is the kind of strip which doesn't seem like it would be all that different in a regular monthly comic, which kind of makes me wonder what it's doing in an experimental, you know, newspaper facsimile like this. Never mind the art being sort of muddy and washed out, and as I say, the writing not being anything special. And the Superman strip I put in the same category, although I give it a little bit more credit for effort. The art is, I enjoy the art a little bit more, but honestly, after 3 weeks, there hasn't been a whole lot going on beyond Superman being all mopey. I think the real standouts of Wednesday Comics continue to be Commandy by Dave Gibbons and Ryan Sook, Hawkman by Kyle Baker, The Flash by Carl Kerschel and Brendan Fletcher, and Strange Adventures by Paul Pope. Personally, I'm enjoying the Batman strip by Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso, and the Green Lantern strip by Kurt Busiek and Joe Quinones, mostly because they seem to be taking the most pains to ape a regular newspaper strip's format. Of course, Commandy does that pretty well, too, copying or aping the style of the old Prince Valiant. But I could actually see Batman and Green Lantern as modern-day newspaper strips. And Green Lantern, I'm almost halfway convinced, is even formatted so that an economical-minded newspaper could lop off the top panel. I'm not recommending that, mind you. I'm just saying it's an interesting little Easter egg. Speaking of Easter eggs, I did appreciate that the future Flash that we see in this week's strip appears to be a descendant of Wally West and Linda Park West, which is a nice little nod to Barry's legacy. I also note that the Supergirl strip is by Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor, and it, again, like their best work on Power Girl, it shows a real vitality, which is maybe better suited to a more densely packed page than a 22-page comic. And finally, speaking of densely packed pages, there's Wonder Woman by Ben Caldwell, and I almost hate to admit this because I've been a big proponent of reading Wednesday comics, you know, as the Lord intended, every Wednesday on its original newsprint. But I have a feeling that this Wonder Woman strip is going to look a lot better once it is collected and put on better paper, and you have more time really to digest each installment and see what's going on in each little panel, and by little panel I mean little panel, and consider it over the whole 12-issue series as opposed to just every week. In other words, I think this Wonder Woman strip may actually be written for the trade, as strange as that may be to contemplate. But overall, I think Wednesday Comics continues to be an excellent package. I'm looking forward to each week's installment. And with that, we'll wrap up this week's installment of the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.